This is the first day of this March 2016 7-day session. And I'm going to be reading and commenting on one of my favorite books, The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim. We have so many more books that have been translated into English, original texts that have been translated into English from Chinese and Japanese sources than Korean sources. This is actually just one of only two that I'm aware of. Anyway, only one of two that I've ever used in Taisho. And I like to give Korean Zen its due. At our annual Zen teachers meetings, I've heard a remark or two from those of the Korean tradition. These are Americans, but who are trained in the Korean tradition, say that the Japanese look down on Korean Zen. There's a sad, long history of occupation by the Japanese in Korea, something like 40 years they occupied Korea, and some real abuses there. And so it's not hard to believe that the less developed of the Japanese teachers would look down on Korean Zen as a whole. But this is one of the most stirring books that I've encountered and translated into English by what seems to be quite an accomplished master, this master Kusan Sunim. Sunim is sort of the Korean equivalent of Roshi. This means senior teacher. Actually, now that I think about it, it may be the equivalent of the Chinese bhikkhu, meaning monk. So I'm not sure. I've looked that up sometime. First, a biographical sketch about this master Kusan. Kusan would be, of course, his family name is, the surname. So, and this book... get the editor of this. It's written by Kusan himself, translated by Martin Fagas, who was once married to Stephen Batchelor, if that name is familiar to anyone. The two of them trained under Kusan Sunim in Korea. So it was translated by her, and it was edited with an introduction by Stephen Batchelor. We'll forego the introduction and just get into Kusan's biographical sketch. He was born in 1909 and died in 1983. We're told here that he was born near a small country town. His parents owned a medium-sized farm, and family life was centered around work in the fields. His parents were Buddhist, but he attended classes at the local Confucian school, where he studied the Chinese classics until he was about 15. When he left school, he continued to help on the family farm and worked as a barber until the age of 29. And during this time, he was also married. From an early age, reading here directly from the text, from an early age, he had periodically been drawn to the monastic way of life. And then, quote, "When I was 9 years old, I remember thinking, could it be possible for someone to be without birth and death? Was it possible to have unlimited powers to move freely through the sky and on the earth? Such thoughts made me want to go and live with the monks in the mountains. But the fear of my missing my parents prevented me from leaving home then. When I was 20, I also considered such a life, but I was not sufficiently determined. And then we see the intercession of one of these events that when they're happening, we think that it's the greatest misfortune, and then it turns out to have set us on a whole new course because it has offered us a whole new perspective on life. At the age of 26, he was stricken by a severe illness that caused him a great deal of pain. Upon seeing him in this condition, a friend who was also a devout Buddhist layman asked him, "Since the abode of the self nature is originally pure, where does your illness lie?" So, in other words, how does this illness, this severe illness and pain, how does this square with what we're told of the purity, the exquisite luminosity of our true nature? So became framed as a koan-like contradiction. These words had a deep effect on Master Kusan. Well, at the time, it was just Kusan. So he decided to go to a certain monastery to recite the mantra of Avalokiteshvara. Now, this is what I had always thought before reading this was strictly a Tibetan Buddhist practice, Om Mani Padme Hung. This is what I, when on one of my pilgrimages to Tibet, this is what you would hear people in public as they were circumambulating a temple or doing prostrations before a Buddha figure. This is what most of them were chanting, Om Mani Padme Hung, Om Mani Padme Hung, Om Mani Padme Hung. And he decided to do this for 100 days. And then after completing this period of recitation, he found himself cured of his illness. This experience also served to strengthen greatly his faith in the Dharma. It's quite a contrast. Many of these great masters, the way they responded or the way they dealt with severe illness compared to people these days, instead of just logging more and more sleep, they would delve into some practice. It could be something like this, or it could just be Zazen, Mu, or whatever koan they're working on, and just go at it with everything they had in the midst of their sickness. And the stories of their cures are very impressive. We always hear in contemporary medicine that the most important thing is sleep, 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 sleep. But this is not conventional medicine. This is going at illness from an entirely different approach. Suppose they would say, these people who do this, that they would see illness as fundamentally something that has gone awry in one's spiritual life. And so from that point of view, would make sense that to come to terms with one's spiritual alienation, let's say, would be the most effective way of bringing about a cure. Three years later, he became convinced that he should dedicate his life to the full-time practice of the teaching of the Dharma. Actually, let me skip. I have a note here to skip to a point later in his biography. It's another cure from illness. I'll just pick it up here. So this, what I just read, this severe illness that he resolved with the help of this reciting, this chant, that was in 1935. And then here in 1938, he said, I had just spent the summer meditation season at a meditation hall with 22 other monks. It had been a fruitful season since I had put a great deal of effort into my practice to the point where I no longer cared whether I lived or died. During this time, I had become a friend with a monk called Paksan Sunim. He was a very serious meditator. Even while walking, he would keep his eyes half closed and never look around him. When the free season arrived, that's when the monks would be free to disperse from their monastery and do pilgrimages. When the free season arrived, Paksan Sunim and I decided to leave the monastery and go elsewhere to continue our practice. However, Soktu Sunim, the teacher of my own teacher, had recently asked me to stay and be his attendant. Thus, I was of two minds as to what I should do. One morning, immediately after breakfast, Paksan Sunim decided to leave. Although I wanted to go with him, I felt that I should heed the request of Soktu Sunim. So he left alone. The morning passed, and having given much thought to my predicament, by lunchtime, I decided that it would have been better, after all, if I had left. So I put my knapsack on my back and left to follow Paksan Sunim. To catch up with my friend, I had to reach such and such a temple, which was about 70 li, that's 30 kilometers away. It's about 20 miles. I walked steadily during the afternoon, but as night fell, there were still 10 li to go. Not knowing the way, I decided to spend the night in a nearby village. During the night, I began to feel very ill. This sudden sickness may have been due to the fact that I had simply overexerted myself. Throughout the summer, I had strenuously pursued my practice, and with hardly a break, had just walked 20 miles in one afternoon carrying a heavy knapsack. The next morning, after the villagers had given me something to eat, I nevertheless continued on my way in spite of the illness. However, my body was racked with pain, and with much difficulty, it took me the entire morning to cover the remaining ground. I finally reached such and such a temple at midday. I met Paksan Sunim at the gate of the temple. He had eaten lunch and was just about to leave for a short walk. Instead, he welcomed me inside. Then, after eating lunch, I had to lie down because of the pain my body was still causing me. For the rest of the afternoon, I was able to rest. But then it had started raining, and we were unable to go out anyway. My illness persisted through the night and into the following morning. By early morning, the rain finally cleared up, but I still felt too sick to continue traveling that day and thought it better to stay in the temple to rest. Shortly, a note came to us from the temple administration announcing that the rain has stopped. This obviously meant that the monks in the temple thought it was time for us to leave. After discussing this matter with Pak San Sunim, we realized that we had no choice but to go. Because I felt so weak and ill, I was at first rather reluctant to set out upon the road, but my friend explained that it would be most troublesome for us to stay any longer. So now I started to reflect upon my situation. For more than a day, I had been literally moaning in illness. My whole body, from the top of my head to the soles of my feet, was in pain. But I thought, a monk practices in order to attain liberation from birth and death and should not be upset by physical pain. And in reality, where was this pain that had been causing me much suffering? Where was it located? In this way, I carefully searched throughout my body for the place of illness. While pursuing this inner search for the pain, I suddenly realized that there was no single place where my pain was located. Although I had scrutinized my entire body from head to toe, I could find no particular pain anywhere. Thereupon, I was immediately cured. This account illustrates how important it is for a meditator to maintain a firm hold on the mind. This is the duty of every cultivator of the way. The mind is as wily as a fox and as mischievous as a goblin. If we just let it be, it will give rise to all kinds of different thoughts. One should not allow this to happen. Instead, if we make a firm decision in our minds, all delusive thoughts can be washed away. In this way, those of us who claim to practice meditation should keenly poise our minds like a very sharp dagger. Thus should we bear ourselves with wisdom. Of course, this takes great faith to do this. Most of us, when we're sick or sick enough, just want to pull into a fetal tuck and under blankets and maybe feel sorry for ourselves. But this is just is a measure of Kusan's great commitment to the Dharma and his faith that these practices can be so powerful in restoring our innate balance. So now I'll go back and pick up where he was at age 30, 1935. So that would have been when he was 26 years old. And then 3 years later, after that, he became convinced that he should dedicate his life to the Dharma. To realize this aim, he left his home and family and started traveling to various monasteries in order to find a teacher. He visited 11 different temples, and he finally came to Songgwangsa. Sa is the Korean word for temple, same as ji is the Japanese word for temple or monastery. This Songgwangsa became his primary monastery, and we'll hear it many times in this account. And there he met a Hyobong Sunim and was immediately convinced that this master would be a good teacher for him. From that time on, he decided to devote himself to the practice of Zen. Now we're going to shift over to just a short biography of this master Hyobong, who became Kusan's teacher. We're told here he was one of the most remarkable Buddhist teachers of this century in Korea. He's born in 1888. In Pyongyang, which is now the capital of North Korea. As a young man, he studied law, and during the Japanese occupation, he was the first Korean who was permitted to become a judge. Since many Koreans strongly resisted the Japanese rule, he was often forced to pass judgment on fellow countrymen accused of anti-Japanese activities. This became an increasing source of conflict for him. After he'd been a judge for 10 years, a case came up in which he was forced to sentence the prisoner to death. The passing of this judgment caused him to question deeply what rights he had to impose punishment on others. He began to doubt the validity of the entire legal system and the society that supported it. One day, he decided that he could no longer continue in such a position. Without telling anyone, he suddenly left his work and home and became a wandering toffee seller. Toffee is a type of taffy candy. For the next 3 years, he drifted through the country, barely supporting himself by selling toffee. All this time, he reflected upon how he could lead a true and honest human life. He finally decided to enter a monastery and start practicing meditation. He became ordained when he was 39. And the author here, Kusan, says, this relatively late start in the monastic life impelled him to practice with especially great earnestness and perseverance. For many years, he stayed in retreat, concentrating solely on resolving the koan mu. The translator here renders mu as no, but it's such a, I think it's a limited, misleading way to translate mu. The best translation I've heard of the word mu is the following. It's not what you think. Yeah, take that and run with it. It's not what you think. Or not applicable would be maybe closer to what seems to me, to what I've read, is a good translation of mu. So we'll use mu instead of no. When he was 43, he built himself a tiny hermitage and sealed himself inside. He left just one small hole in the wall through which food could be passed in and out. For 1.5 years, he remained in complete solitude. Finally, his mind's eye opened, and he realized that at last all of his doubts had been resolved. As an expression of his awakening, he wrote the following lines. At the bottom of the ocean, a deer hatches an egg in a swallow's nest. In the heart of a fire, a fish boils tea in a spider's web. Who knows what is happening in this house? White clouds float westward. The moon rises in the east. During the next 30 years, this master Hyobong became a widely known and respected teacher, and he was eventually appointed the spiritual head of the Chogye order of Zen. Or, to use the Korean name for Zen, it's Son, S-O-N, Son. So, this became Kusan's teacher. When he met Hyobong, told him that he wished to become a monk and asked him to take him as his disciple. Master Hyobong agreed, and instructed him in the koan mu. 8 months later, he received novice ordination and entered the meditation hall in Songguangsa under the guidance of his teacher. And then at the age of 31, he took full ordination as a bhikshu, that is, a celibate monk. From the beginning, Master Kusan was only interested in the practice of Zen and never attended a sutra school to study the Buddhist sutras. Just a sidebar here, the large Korean monasteries were divided into two segments. There was the wing of the monastery that focused on study of the sutras, and then the other section was for meditation, zazen. Here we're told that Kusan had no interest in studying. He wanted to really get the direct experience. And he said, "I chose to enter the Zen sect because I thought that through meditation I would be able to free myself from birth and death and gain the power to transform this world into a Buddha realm. In the sutra schools, one is only told about cultivating the mind and awakening. I felt it would be better to actually realize these things instead." Hello, of course. As soon as he took up the practice of meditation, he did so with a tremendous resolve and determination. These are his words. "When I started meditating, I was firmly convinced that I would be able to complete the practice within the 3 months of the first retreat period." They would have these 90-day stretches of more serious practice, alternating with those 3 month periods where they would disperse to other parts of the country. "I exerted myself to the point where I no longer cared whether I lived or died. But as the 3 months drew to an end and I had still not realized my goal, I wanted to die since I felt it was no longer worth living." So this, let me just comment that this kind of almost fanatical resolve is admirable in its own way. It shows the tremendous fiber and strength of mind that Kusan had. But it also shows an impurity in setting it up this way. We'll hear more from him. "Once while doing standing meditation in order to prevent drowsiness," this is a practice that is followed in Korean Zen, is if you find you're just dozing off in the Zendo, you can stand up and continue your zazen standing until you feel you've shaken off the drowsiness. "Once while he was doing that, I thought of drowning myself or throwing myself off a high cliff. But at that very moment, a huge snow-capped mountain appeared before me. This made me recall that the Buddha had practiced for 6 full years at the feet of such mountains. I then realized that it was somewhat presumptuous for me to want to complete my training in 3 months. Thereupon, I renounced my intention to die and redoubled my efforts." During the following years, Kusan Sunim continued to pursue his practice of sitting After spending a number of seasons in meditation halls, he decided that he needed the solitude of a hermitage in order to be able to concentrate himself fully on his practice. So he would spend his time in small, remote hermitages, often completely by himself. And he says, at these times when I was hungry, I would find something to eat. When thirsty, I would drink. When the room was cold, I would light a fire under the floor. I tried to practice as hard as I could and would sleep very little. This was the standard form of indoor heating in Korea, is under the stone floors they would keep a fire. Fire is burning to keep the floor and warm and everything else with it. His disciples recall that in those days Master Kusan was a very stern and even frightening figure. He would demand exemplary conduct from all the younger students of his teacher and urge them to work hard all day and meditate through the night. He would constantly remind them that they never knew when they might die, that they would be finished should the mere breath in their nostrils come to a stop. If a young monk were to waste a few grains of rice or a single cabbage leaf, as a punishment, he would sometimes make him go without food for the rest of the day. He himself was a devoted disciple to his teacher and a tireless worker. Here we see this traditional emphasis in Zen on not wasting water, not wasting electricity, and above all, not wasting food. And I count on our own cooks, head cooks, and others in the kitchen to preserve this policy and be vigilant of when people haven't cleaned bowls or plates in the kitchen well enough. His first important experience in meditation occurred after he had been meditating continuously for 7 days with the intense resolve to awaken before the memorial ceremony for a close friend who had recently died. However, he did not consider this a true awakening. And then these are his words. While meditating, such experiences sometimes happen. You could say it was a certain opening of the mind's eye. It was the transition over a difficult step that enabled me to first gain admittance to the door. Perhaps you could call it an initial breakthrough. It showed that my practice was progressing well. So you see, he's not claiming this as some exalted experience, or not even awakening. He's not using the awakening, the word awakening. But it was a shift in his practice. This is often what precedes what we would call kensho or awakening. It's so hard to articulate what it is. It's a shift in one's relationship to the koan or to one's practice. That is felt outside sitting as well. He then went to a small hermitage that he had built. He stayed there for 3 years, and in 1946, he experienced a major breakthrough. This occurred after he had entered a state in which, for 15 days, he lost any sense of the outside world. He was no longer concerned whether he lived or died. He was so absorbed in his meditation that birds would come and sit on his head and shoulders and take pieces of stuffing that protruded from his padded coat for their nests. After this, he came down to the main temple and delivered a formal Dharma discourse to the monks. He recorded his experience in the following stanza. Look at the front of the mirror. It is completely dark. Let me just pause and say, the mirror is a long-standing analogy for the mind. Because like a mirror, our mind is fundamentally, the fundamental nature of our mind is empty of any form. It's formless, and yet it reflects all forms. In some Korean monasteries, I read elsewhere in this text, instead of a Buddha figure in the Zendo, they have a mirror. Again, his verse. Look at the front of the mirror, it is completely dark. Look at the back, and it is brilliantly clear. Looking at the front, it is not the front. Looking at the back, it is also not the back. When both front and back are shattered, then truly one has a great complete mirror. And then the author brings in inevitably the turmoil, the political turmoil that was happening at the time. Shortly after the outbreak of the Korean War, communist forces overran the temple and took all the monks prisoner. Kusan Sunim and Master Hyo Bong managed to avoid capture and escaped to the region around Busan, where UN forces were in control. Being a conscientious member of the Sangha, Master Kusan was always aware of his wider obligations to the Buddhist community in Korea. After the war, he accepted a number of administrative positions in order to assist in the regeneration of the Buddhist order. Just to comment on this, he was always aware of his wider obligations to the Buddhist community in Korea. So, His willingness to serve in administrative positions that he would not otherwise want to serve in. He sounds like a real true contemplative who would be happy to just sit day and night his whole life. But he recognizes that this is the kind of work that in order to maintain the monastic sangha, that someone has to do this kind of work. And so, having seen into his true nature, he was willing to put aside his own preferences in order to serve the greater good. However, he still felt that his practice of meditation needed to be deepened. Therefore, he eventually resigned his posts and went to a small hermitage. And he sat there for 3 years until he underwent another awakening. And Master Hyo Bong confirmed this awakening and said, "Until now you have been following me, now it is I who should follow you." And so in 1962, at the request of his teacher, he came out of retreat and accepted the position of abbot. He remained there for 4 years, and then he went off in 1966. He went abroad for the first time to attend some international Buddhist conferences in Sri Lanka. Southeast Asia, India, Nepal. And then shortly after he returned, his teacher, Master Hyalbong, passed away in the meditation posture. Shortly before he died, he uttered his final poem. "All my words of Dharma were superfluous. You ask me about today's matter? I tell you that the moon is shining over 1,000 rivers. The following year, Master Kusan moved to Songguangsa. 2 years later, he was installed as the spiritual director of the community. One of his main tasks at that time was the rebuilding of the principal meditation hall and the reestablishment of regular Zen training sessions. At the conclusion of his inaugural speech on this occasion, Master Kusan exhorted the monks who were present with these characteristic words of advice. "In practicing meditation, you should be prepared to grab hold of the blade of a sword so sharp that it cuts through hairs merely blown against it. Could you possibly do that in your ordinary frame of mind? As long as you are afraid of the sharpness of the blade, you are bound to cut yourself. But in firmly gripping the blade with an utterly intrepid mind, you will not even be scratched." Here we could also understand this as, of course, it's a metaphor, to be afraid of going with less sleep, let's say, or going with less food. This is something that plagues people sometimes in Sesshin, where they're held back by a fear that if they sit up late into the night, that they won't be much good the next day. But if you're sitting a lot at night doing yaza, then you're consolidating, you're storing up a lot of energy. And yes, you may be tired the next day, but it's a different kind of tiredness than what we can experience outside Sesshin. There's some things I want to skip so we can wrap this up. He was constantly being invited to give lectures, perform ceremonies, attend meetings in temples throughout Korea. And this is interesting. During his later years, the wrathful demeanor for which he was noted earlier in his life gave way to a kind and compassionate nature that always seemed to have room for any monk or layperson who was in need of his advice. This is something you see sometimes in people who aren't involved in spiritual practice, that they become, they mellow in their old age. But it's more likely to happen through a lifetime of practice. Certainly I saw it happen to Roshi Kaplow in his 80s. And it talks about more traveling that he did to the United States and other countries. And now, 1983, he started to show signs of illness. The following day, he gathered his disciples in his room and indicated that he would not live for much longer. From this point on, his health gradually deteriorated. He confined himself to his quarters in Songguangsa and then passed away in the meditation posture. He was 74. 3 days before he died, he uttered his final words of Dharma. Samsara and Nirvana are originally not two. As the sun rises in the sky, it illuminates the 3,000 worlds. And his body was cremated, and his bones were ground to powder and scattered near the site of his old hermitage at the foot of Mount Chogye. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.